Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to the first episode in season three, I'm calling it season three, of Wild Wild Podcast. I am here as ever with my co-host Rod Barnett. Hello Rod.
Hello Adrian, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm excited to be switching things up again here to a different genre. I'm also very excited because just recently I booked a plane ticket to Rome. So I'm going to Rome again for the first time in 3 years this summer. So I'm very excited about that. So I will go around and I'll get myself a scooter and I'll race them around the streets pretending that I'm in one of these movies. And that should be fun. Yeah. Anyway, I'm sure I will bang on about that as I get closer to going.
Is there an event for this, or are you just going for the heck of it?
Oh, I'm going for a conference. I'm giving a paper at an academic conference. I will actually be speaking about French films rather than Italian films, but the conference is in Rome, so that seemed like a good reason to go. Sure. So anyway, but yes, I'm sure I'll go on about that when I'm getting there. That's not till July, by which time we'll have finished talking about Poliziotteschi films and moved on to something else. Probably, maybe, we'll see. How quickly?
Yeah, we'll see how this goes.
Can get through. So we're planning to do 10 films altogether, and we'll try and whiz through them. We'll see how well organised I can be with that. But this, unlike our space season, where we pretty much did every Italian space film that there was, there's no way we can do that this time because there are dozens and dozens of Poliziotteschi films.
So many.
Rather than do the 10, I looked at lots of films and lists, and rather than trying to just do the 10 most popular or even the 10 most obscure or any kind of theme to collecting them together, I've effectively just looked at my own DVD collection. And
it's not a bad way to go. Yeah,
well, you know, I've got some that I've watched, some that I still haven't watched, and this is a good excuse. Plus Arrow put out a box set last year of films which are really interesting, so I've basically picked titles at random. I've tried to avoid, because it would be very easy to just do all by the same director, like we could just do loads of Sergio Martino films or loads of De Leo films or Umberto Lenzi. I've tried to mix things up a bit, but we'll see. We'll see how it goes. But this time we're starting with one from 1972. So I have put the 10 that we're doing in date order. So this will be the earliest of all of them. And I have chosen for our first episode one of the big hitters, one of the great early Polizia Teschi films, Milano Calibro 9 or Milan Caliber 9.
One heck of a film, yeah.
Cue the funky music.
Yes.
Some music in there. There's loads of great music in this film. Oh, we should say, in case anybody is listening who's not familiar, Rod, could you describe what a Polizia Teschi film is?
It's a specifically Italian genre that revolves around crime stories involving both the police and the gangsters that they're chasing. From film to film, you can get a different point of view. This film is primarily focused on the criminals, but there are a number of films in this genre that are primarily focused on the cops. It just depends on whatever the filmmakers decided to do.
Yeah, and I read somewhere, it might be in the book that I'm going to be mainly drawing on for this season by Roberto Curti, called The Italian Crime Filmography, which is a really great reference book. And in there he talks about Polizia Teschi. The word sort of translates as police-esque or police-ish.
Yeah.
And it was the name that was given to a bunch of these films by film critics as kind of a criticism. Like, these films are police-ish. It's one of those terms that sort of stuck, but it's not necessarily complimentary. But it nevertheless has come to sort of define a broad swathe of these films. That they're also, the sort of time period that these films come out of was known as the Years of Lead. And we'll perhaps talk more about the Years of Lead as we go through. But it was a very violent time in Italy, the 1970s. There was crime, there was bombings, gang warfare, police corruption.
A lot of homegrown terrorism in Italy at the time.
Yeah, left-wing terrorists, right-wing terrorists, public bombings, and elements of those things do come into these films. And you read about some movies when they were making films that they're filming people getting shot or bombed in Rome, and then just around the corner, people really did get shot or bombed whilst they were filming. I've read bits about that, like actors talking about this happening for real just where they were filming and things. It was a pretty scary time, and the public were just exposed to this all the time in the news. And so it's sort of interesting that the filmmakers picked up on it and started making, you'd almost think like they wouldn't want to watch films about this stuff because it's all happening for real, but for some reason it really caught on. And I think it was also the popularity of films like Dirty Harry and The French Connection were big influences on this genre. Many of the films bear some resemblance to Dirty Harry or The French Connection. Or like you said, also the sort of gangster-led ones as well. Not so much The Godfather, that didn't seem to be a huge influence. These are much more down and dirty, street-level kind of films with fabulous soundtracks. Very often by Stelvio Cipriani. He seems to be all over these films. But anyway, okay. But let's talk about this one then. So Milan Caliber Number 9. I've got a plot summary, a very useful plot summary, which we can use to go through. And we can also talk a little bit about the cast. Maybe we should talk about the cast and the director first.
Probably a good idea, yeah.
As with the last couple of seasons, most of the films that we're doing, I'm coming to for the first time. But okay. I have actually, this is a film that I did see a few years ago, although I realised when I watched it this time, about the only thing I'd remembered was Barbara Boucher's dance scene. I don't know, I mean, that might not come as a surprise, but that was the bit that had really stuck in my head. So Fernando Di Leo, he is a director who's perhaps best known for this genre, although he did make other kinds of films too. And he was a writer and a director. what of his movies, what really stuck out for you?
Well, I'm kind of fascinated by Fernando de Leo's entire career. He broke in as a writer and had a hand in the first two of Sergio Leone's spaghetti Western films, A Fistful of Dollars and For a Few Dollars More. And when you know that, you realize, oh, okay, there's a reason why every time I see one of his movies that he started, once he started directing, he always wrote or co-wrote those films as well. They're always very tight scripts because he came from that world in the first place where the idea was to keep these things as close to the bone as possible. There's no we'll figure it out once we're on the street. There's just really good scripts here. And so all the movies that I've seen by him so far, and this was the first one. This is the first one of his crime films that I ever checked out a couple years back. Once they came out on Blu-ray, it became a lot easier. There are these Blu-ray sets that came out here in the States on Raro Video. You could just plow through these things. These are tight, really well-made, typical of the time as far as the genre is concerned, crime movies. And he makes the cops viable characters as well, but he has a tendency to stick to the criminals. And I think that's all for the better, really, because he really seems to have a good handle on how create nuanced bad guys.
Yeah. And even sometimes, he wrote the script for Live Like a Cop, Die Like a Man.
Yeah.
Which is one of the best of those, although he didn't direct that one. That was Ruggero Deodato. And it makes you wonder why he didn't direct it himself. Perhaps he was just too busy with all the other films he had going on. But
yeah, it may have been a scheduling problem, yeah.
Yeah, in that one, the cops are pretty much as bad as the villains. those are not cops that you would really want to have solving any crimes that you
know. No, they're vicious.
But yeah, he's got an amazing list of credits. I mean, he wrote loads of Westerns, as you mentioned. He did Massacre Time, the Lucio Fulci one as well.
Yeah.
And a whole bunch of stuff. And that sort of attitude that of the spaghetti Westerns really comes through in these movies that are shot running around on the streets in Milan or wherever we are. So he's really interesting. And I need to get those sets that you mentioned, because this is the only one that I have, because I have the Arrow edition of this one. But it's a really impressive, stylish film, great soundtrack. Interesting cast as well. Now, obviously, I've mentioned Barbara Boucher already, who we were just talking about in the previous episode. Cast because she's very good at what she does, but also she's extremely beautiful and doesn't mind dancing around.
and almost nothing.
Yeah, it's quite an astonishing. The way that sequence is shot, my goodness, we'll get to it.
the camera loves her, let's put it that way.
Yeah. There's a couple of other interesting people in the cast in this film. So the lead actor, so is a guy called Gaston Mouchin, who plays Ugo Piazza. And apparently he was best known as a comedian. He mainly did comedy films.
I know, I found that out, I was shocked.
Yeah. But then after he did this movie, it kind of reinvented him as this moody, kind of stone-faced, criminal, kind of scary guy, that really changed the direction of his career. But yeah, I've never seen any of his comedies, but I am kind of curious to see how that worked. But he's got a very long list of films before he did this one. And interesting that Fernando de Leo would take a chance on a comedy actor to take the lead role in this film.
Well, he has the look. I mean, he's this shaved head, kind of like bullheaded looking guy he looks intimidating in almost any way you can come at him. And the success he had in roles like this, it's huge. I mean, this happened with a few actors, but he became so, so well known and so well thought of. I mean, he ended up in The Godfather Part Two.
Oh yeah, that's true. Yeah. And so he's up against this guy who's the sort of lead gangster for the area who he worked with, who's played by an American actor called Lionel Stander. And I've been reading a little bit about him, and he's really interesting. He was involved in the, he was a Communist Party member who was exposed in the House of Un-American Activities, and all that stuff. And so he ended up being blacklisted for a while, and that's how he sort of ended up working in Italy and in Europe and doing all kinds of interesting films in Europe.
Well, he had an incredibly long career, but
Yeah, I mean, he'd done lots of stuff going right back to the 1930s in Hollywood, and then after the blacklist, he was, well, you know, difficult to find work, and ended up doing spaghetti westerns and all kinds of things, and then ends up in this film. Yeah.
He's, well, I mean, if perfect. You look at his list of credits, it's insane. I mean, Cul-de-sac in 66, A Dandy in Aspic, Once Upon a Time in the West.
Heart to Heart.
Well, yeah, that's where I knew his face from immediately, was because when I was a kid, that was just a standard television show that everybody kind of watched one way or another. And yeah, he was on every episode of that and all the reunion TV movies in the 90s up until his death.
And he even ended up later on in the 1970s in 1941, your favorite Spielberg film.
I wouldn't say favorite, but yeah, he's actually quite amusing at that as well.
Yeah. So, yes, it's a very interesting cast. There's one guy in here that we're going to talk about whose character's name is Rocco, played by Mario Adorf. And I just found it impossible to watch this film and not see Bruce Campbell.
In that role, really?
No, just he looks just so much like Bruce Campbell that whenever he's on screen, I just kept thinking it was Bruce Campbell. And he plays... he's so over the top. He's like he is a comedy actor in this film. He's playing this film like he's in a comedy, and everyone else is playing it like they're in a gangster film.
And one of the things that makes that work is that every other character in the movie really doesn't like him, and they just have to put up with him. Yeah.
Yeah. But he looks so much like Bruce Campbell, it's uncanny.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about that until you pointed it out, but you're right.
So I couldn't see it as being anyone else but Bruce Campbell, which added an extra layer of entertainment for me. But anyway, shall we go through the plot and then we can talk about it as we go?
Excellent idea.
Small-time gangster Ugo Piazza is released from jail where he's been serving a 3-year sentence for robbery, just to find that his former boss, the American, has sent his men to pick him up. Now, straight away, this has missed out the pre-credit sequence, which is the sort of setup for what has happened here. Yeah. He's been in jail for 3 years, and he got caught involved in a crime, and some money went missing. $300,000 American dollars disappeared during this crime. And so the pre-credit sequence of this film, we see this very elaborate sequence of people swapping bags on tube trains and in train stations and in a square in Milan and all this kind of thing, as they're sort of trying to get this money back to the this guy Rocco. And then he opens the bag of money and it's just full of paper, I think. Right, it's just full of paper. Yeah. So then they gather up all these people who've been involved in this crossover thing. I think there's 3 people, a woman and 2 guys. And then you cut to this, they're beating them up and they don't know where the money is. And then suddenly they're in a cave and they've put gunpowder on them. Dynamite, I mean. And then they blow them up.
In the cave, yes. This is how they execute these people.
Presumably to cause the cave to completely cave in. And then nobody will ever find them. But you do get the sense that Rocco here is a bit unhinged.
Bit of a psycho.
So, yeah. So then 3 years later, Rocco is the guy who's picking up Ugo as he is walking home after he's been released from prison. And it turns out that they think he's the one who stole the money. So presumably the other 3 people they killed, but Rocco got caught and arrested, so they couldn't kill him then or ask him where it was. So they've been waiting patiently for him to come out of prison. Apparently they'd tried to get to him in prison. They'd sent people in there to beat him up. But he claims he doesn't know where the money is. He hasn't got it. He didn't steal it. But that's the central sort of driving force in the plot here, is that everyone else thinks he stole the money and he says he didn't. And I believe him. He seems like a nice guy. He's very genuine. He wants to just put his head down and live a normal life with his beautiful girlfriend.
Which is understandable. I mean, he's kind of forced in a way, not really forced, but what else is he going to do? He kind of falls back into working for his old boss again because, one, they want to keep an eye on him.
Yeah, because if they do that, then they're not going to kill him.
Right.
So it's kind of self-preservation. So he, because yeah, they when they pick him up outside the prison, they beat him up, but he keeps telling them that he hasn't got the money. And then that he refuses to go and meet the American. They keep saying, come to the American, he wants to see you. And he's like, nope. So then Rocco and his men track down Ugo again to a hotel, a seedy hotel, it says here. It is pretty seedy.
Yeah.
It has to be said. And they catch him with a prostitute and they drag her out of the room and then they beat him up again. And then they trash the room. And Rocco is just a nutter. He's so, like, insane. It's a miracle that he's...
It's a miracle that someone hasn't killed him just to keep everybody else in the world safe.
Yeah, because he's so unhinged. So then he goes to visit his friend Kino, who turns out is an old associate of his, who lives with the guy who they call the Godfather. So I think there was a guy who Ugo and Kino used to work for who was a kind of mafia boss. Yeah. And now he's old and he's blind. He's lost all of his power and he just lives with Kino, who's this guy who used to be an assassin for hire. And Ugo goes to see him because he needs money. He hasn't got any money. And he needs to pay for the damage to the hotel. And he needs help. But Kino doesn't really want to get involved because I guess he's got his own reasons.
Well, reason number one would be everybody knows that the Americans still thinks that Ugo stole that money. And so
he doesn't want him to think that he's involved, I suppose. Right. But he does offer to give him the money because he's a nice guy. But then, whilst he's there, who pops up again? But Rocco, he is like whack-a-mole. He just won't. You can't keep him down. Rocco turns up again, starts beating up on the Godfather and smashing up the place. So Kino beats him up. Which is really fun because he kind of turns the tables on him.
Yeah, Kino Rocco really takes him to town, man. He undoes him, yeah.
And Rocco suddenly is not the most powerful guy in the room. And he forces Rocco to... Rocco grabs the money that Kino's given Ugo and tears it in half. And so after Kino has given him a good sorting out, he makes him pay the money back, which is great. So Rocco is sort of humbled a little bit. But he's like, oh, the American won't like it. And so then this is when he gets offered a job. That's right. So he goes to see the American, as you said. He gets offered a job because the American decides not to kill Ugo because if he kills him, he'll never find out where the money is, I guess. So instead, he wants him to work for him, doing what? Just kind of general gangster stuff.
He's kind of as an enforcer, somebody that he can send on jobs to make sure things get done, which is apparently what his job used to be.
Yeah. Yeah, he's like a gopher, gangster gopher. So now that he knows that he's safe and he's not going to get killed, he goes to visit his girlfriend, or former girlfriend, the beautiful nightclub dancer, Nelly.
What to move? I don't got a thing in the mood.
this is where we discover that Nelly is dancing in a gold bikini in this amazing sequence. The cinematography in this is really quite something. It's she's dancing away, and they tilt the camera 90 degrees so that you get her full length.
The widescreen image is nothing but her. Yeah.
But it's her sideways.
Yep.
So it's like nowadays somebody would be filming her on their phone. But then, you know, trying to play it back, it's playing it sideways. But it's a great sequence. She's a very good dancer. And everyone in the whole place is watching her, sort of mesmerized. And then Ugo is there. And so she goes to talk to him. Now, of course, just the night before, we've seen him with a prostitute. And so she's like, oh, you got out of jail yesterday. Why didn't you come to see me then? And he has to explain, oh, I wanted to make sure I wasn't going to get killed first. Some lame excuse.
Well, the idea being, you know, if I come straight to you,
yeah,
they might have just beaten the hell out of you because they would figure that you would know something about the money.
So that's fine. He didn't mention the fact that he was with a prostitute the night before. That wasn't.
Well, yeah, you don't tell the whole truth.
You don't just tell everything, no. So while he's there in this bar, he's clearly friends with the bar staff, and he meets this kid who is like, oh, hasn't he? I've forgotten his name, but he's grown. Luca, that's his name. Oh, yeah, hasn't Luca grown now? He was only so high when you were here before or something. And so it's all very friendly. But she believes, so Nelly seems to believe that he did steal the money. So I think she's hoping that he's going to take her away with him with all this 300,000, but he keeps insisting he hasn't got it.
Yeah, he's very clear with her. He's like, I don't know who did. I don't have it. If I had it, why would I be here? Yeah. You know.
But he's agreed to work for the Americans so he can find out who has it. That's what he's told her.
Yeah, he's telling her, which the simple idea that if he's working for the American again, he might be able to finally figure out who actually stole the money and framed him.
And there's a suggestion that it might have been the American himself.
Yeah, he seems to think that it might have been some kind of sleight of hand. Yeah.
Just like, just to mess with everybody or something.
Or to keep them on their toes and you know, kind of paranoid and not trusting of each other so that they'll actually just, you know, stick with the big boss instead of making possible inroads and alliances between each other. Yeah.
And then he has to go with another one of these gangster guys. I've forgotten their names. There's so many of them. But he has to go with them. They're doing a deal in a bowling alley. They're swapping some money with somebody from Switzerland, I think. There's some kind of exchange going down at this bowling alley. And so Ugo is there just sort of watching the whole thing. And then when they do the switch, his guy goes to the toilets of the bowling alley to count the money. But that's when this mysterious guy, we don't know who he is, we don't see his face, turns up, shoots him and steals the money. And so Ugo finds out what's happened, and it's all, oh, what's going on? Who is it? Who is it? And then Rocco says, oh, we know who did it. We know who did it. Let's go. And they're going to drive, and they're going to shoot whoever it was. Now, in the book here, I disagree with his description here. It says here, Rocco is convinced that Don Vincenzo, that's the old Godfather guy, and Kino are behind it and prepare a fatal ambush. Now, I don't think that's true.
No, that's
I don't think Rocco really believes that they did it. I think he just wants to kill Kino and the Godfather. And so he set this whole thing up because he said to Ugo, right, you're going to be the one who shoots them out the window when we drive past. And so they're driving along, and then Kino and the Don Vincenzo come around the corner. And he's like, shoot now, shoot now, shoot now. And I think Rocco just wants to make Ugo kill them.
Right, but he refuses to do it. He won't do it.
So then Rocco shoots out the window and kills Don Vincenzo, but not Kino. But yeah, so yeah, in the book...
Kino gets away, yeah.
Yeah, in the book, he makes it sound like Rocco really believed that, but I think Rocco is just a horrible guy.
I agree.
Basically. And so he's just set this up to upset Ugo. And then because of that all went wrong, they beat up Ugo again. All the time, he still keeps swearing that he didn't steal the money.
Yeah, Kino, and the thing becomes, I mean, I love the logic that he's using. Ugo is being beat to hell, and he's going, why would I? someone you already suspect of stealing $300,000 from you steal another $30,000 right in front of you. Why would I do that? There's no one in this room who has less reason to do something this stupid.
Yeah. And so then we have, and this is where the film really kicks into the final act, when there's a party at the American's house. It looks like a very nice place. It's like a villa.
Yeah, it's kind of a rural estate. It's a really nice place.
Although he's got a swimming pool that's empty, which I thought was a bit weird for a party. He's just got an empty pool, which is interesting. So there's this party going on. There are girls. There's all the gangsters are there. Ugo is there. But then Kino, who is out for revenge, and we already know he's a proper trained killer. He turns up at this party and just starts shooting everybody.
He's mowing everybody down.
Yeah, this is a massive massacre of this party. Pretty much everybody, including the American, gets shot by Kino.
Yep.
And so Ugo sees what's going on, and he goes out, because all the men are trying to fight back and shoot at Kino. And so Ugo is there pretending that he's going to shoot at Kino, but then he just turns around and starts shooting the other guys as well, until basically everybody at this party is dead. Except for Ugo and the girls. I think they were all hiding in the house. But unfortunately, Kino has been hit. And they have a heart-to-heart, and then Kino is dead. So Ugo, at this point, he leaves the party. And he leaves quite slowly at first, but then he starts to like run. And he jumps in a car. And where is he driving, Rod?
This is the big twist. Out in the middle of nowhere. We have no idea where he's going or what he's doing.
He ends up at this deserted farmhouse, where, if we haven't worked it out by now, here comes the final act twist. He did steal the money.
He did steal the $300,000 three years before. Yeah, and he stashed it somewhere and told absolutely nobody.
Now, we don't know how he did it, and we don't know how he managed to get the money and hide it in the attic of an abandoned farmhouse.
But it doesn't matter. The beauty is he did it.
Now, it reminded me, there's a film, and I can't remember what it's called, and I can't even remember who's in it, where some guys steal some money and then they hide it in a building site because they're about to get caught by the police. And then they go to prison. And when they come back a few years later, they go to where it was and there's a police station. Like the building site was a police station.
Oh, that does ring a bell, yeah.
I can't remember what that film is. Somebody might know and tell us. But it sort of reminded me of that. Like, it's a bit of a risk to hide your money in a house for 3 years. Like, you could come back and anything could have happened to that house.
It's true.
But so it turns out that he did steal the money. So now that everybody is dead, including the American.
He's safe.
Apart from Rocco.
Who's still running around out there somewhere, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think Rocco was at the party or something.
No, he wasn't.
So Rocco is okay. He's got the money. And he is racing back to Nelly's place. Because I think he's given her a call. He's telling her.
Well, yeah, but before he gets there, he's picked up by the cops, who've also been threaded throughout this story as well. Because they're trying to lean on Ugo to try to get him. They're not so much worried about the money as they're trying to find a way to leverage the problems he has with his old boss as a way to get him to help the cops put the American and his entire syndicate kind of out of business. So they pick him up after he's picked up the money. They pick him up again to ask him some more questions about all the shit that's been going down, and that's where he runs into Rocco at the police station, and a mutual understanding has come to between the two of them because Rocco sees the
sports bag full of money, and he realizes that Ugo has actually been playing them all along.
Yep.
Yeah, I know you're right. We forgot to mention the police. There's these two policemen who just spend the whole film arguing with each other. And I did read somewhere that Fernando de Leo regretted leaving their scenes in.
Well, there's at least one or two of their scenes that probably should have been excised.
Because they don't really add anything to the plot. It's basically an older commissioner and a younger cop played by Luigi Pastilli, who I recognize him from loads of films, actually, the younger cop.
But those scenes do feel... face. They do feel like a director who's... Well, they feel like a writer... slash director who is in love with what he's written and doesn't want to cut it out.
Because they basically just spend the whole time arguing about the about sort of injustice, social injustice.
This it's politics.
This guy, Mercury, is talking. He's from the south, and in Italy, the south of Italy is sort of quite poverty stricken, and so he's talking about this the level of injustice between people from the south and people from the north. And the other guy, he just won't hear any of it. But I thought it was interesting because, like I was saying before, this whole time in Italy was a lot very political, and there's a lot of left-wing terrorism and right-wing terrorism, and a lot of it was about this sort of social injustice. So it's interesting that some of these arguments were being played out by the police, but it did feel a bit like it didn't really add anything to the plot, which is
I understand why he would have wanted to have this kind of thing in the movie, because it's kind of teasing out some of the underlying kind of societal conflicts that are causing the problems that they're all dealing with. Mm-hmm. But it's unnecessary, really.
Yeah, you're right, because Mercury says, you know, well, it's no good just going after the American. We need to find out where the money is coming from.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, he's not wrong, but at the same time, in the film itself, it's kind of it's good to have it there, but bad because it slows the film down unnecessarily in stuff that we're really not that interested in.
The American is involved in money laundering, and it's like, where is this money coming from? And so Mercury seems like he's more interested in the bigger picture of trying to solve this. And the commissioner is going along with it for a while, but eventually he recommends him for promotion just to get rid of him.
Well, I kept waiting for them to be a little bit more clear about what they're obviously alluding to, which is the kind of larger idea of we have one side in the cops who want to cut the head off the snake and the other side who's just trying to stab the snake wherever they can find it. And it's like, yeah, but then we'll never kill it. You know, we'll never stop it.
Yeah. But I was reading I think it might have been the Blu-ray booklet, where Fernando de Leo said that as a writer, he was pleased with those scenes, but as a director, he should have cut them out. Which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
The reason I recognise the actor, he's in loads of films, but just recently I've seen him in The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, because I watched that again recently.
Oh, yeah.
And he was in that. And he's also in The Case of the Scorpion's Tail, The Iguana with the Tongue of Fire, Bay of Blood. So he's a guy that you'll recognise if you watch any of these kinds of Italian cult movies. Luigi Pistilli. But yeah, so the cops have been trying to get Ugo to be an informer, and he won't. They end up arresting him, but he's got an alibi. He's not involved, so they end up letting him go. But Rocco has twigged that Ugo has got the money and been playing them all along. So he says to Ugo, let's team up. And it's like Rocco, and again, I mean, this isn't my observation, I read this somewhere else, but Rocco is the beta wolf. He's not the alpha wolf. Rocco is a guy who recognizes leadership and then will follow it blindly. So Rocco, he'll serve the American and do whatever the American wants. Now the American is dead and Ugo has been playing them all along. Rocco sees Ugo and wants to work for Ugo now. Like, he straight away switches allegiance because that's the kind of guy he is. He's not a born leader, but he's a very dedicated right-hand man.
So, and it's surprising to me how well played that is, because it is a third act situation where you can actually realize that this psycho lunatic is aware enough of his own position in society and the way things are that, you know, having someone who tells him what he should be doing is a good idea. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just the look on his face when he realizes, and he just so quickly changes, and all of a sudden he wants to be Ugo's best mate despite having been beating him up for the last 90 minutes. But Ugo says he'll consider it. He tells him, you know, I'll think about it. So anyway, Ugo leaves and heads off to see Nelly, gets to Nelly's place. But what he doesn't realize,
he and Nelly, their plan is to take the money and get the hell out. I think they're going to South America. They're just getting out.
Yeah, Beirut, isn't it? They keep talking about Beirut.
Is it Beirut? I can't remember. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
They keep talking about going to Beirut, which I don't know why. I think Beirut may have been a bit of an Italian like colony at the time, a popular place for people to go from Italy. I'm not entirely sure why.
Well, I know in the 70s, Beirut was considered like a resort town. So.
Yeah. And a good place to disappear to, I suppose.
Yeah.
Particularly if the money that you have is ill-gotten gains.
Also possibly a good place to use as a, you know, kind of like an airline hub, and you can go anywhere from there.
Yeah. But of course, what Ugo doesn't know is that Nelly has actually been cheating on him this whole time with Luca, a little boy from the bar who's a big man now. And Luca is the one who stole the other money. Luca has been the thorn in their side all this time. And Luca is hiding, ready to kill Ugo as soon as he turns up at her apartment. And poor Ugo, he's managed to get this money after hiding and going through all this stuff. And he turns up her apartment, and Nelly just screams like, shoot him, shoot him, shoot him. No compassion at all.
That look on Ugo's face as she's screaming, shoot him. It's realizes, that look of utter of shock and betrayal is amazing.
Yeah, because he really felt like he'd done it, and he really obviously, you know, cared for her and didn't have a clue that she'd been playing him and that they were just going to kill him and steal the money. So Nelly was playing the long game as well. She was waiting for him to turn up with the money so she could do this. And so they do. It's really sad. They kill Ugo. He shoots him in the back. But then, just while they're grabbing all their stuff to leave, who should turn up but Bruce Campbell again? Because he's dead keen to come and work for Ugo. He's like a little puppy dog. He's followed him there. But then he sees what's happened. And this is a really actually very dramatic scene. It's a different side of Rocco. And, well, yeah, do you want to describe what happens?
Well, I mean, he beats Luca to death.
Yeah.
And he seems so enraged that he's beside himself, and he beats him to death and then punches Nelly. And it seems to have killed her too.
Oh, yeah. He's like, oh, that's true. Yeah, he punches her in the face.
Yeah.
Or was that Ugo? No, Ugo punched her in the face, I think. Didn't he?
Oh, that's right. Okay, yeah, you're right.
I think Ugo punched her in the face just before the last shot. And so she's bleeding profusely. And Luca is trying to help her. And that's when Rocco comes in
and beats Luca to death.
Yeah. And it's great. He's smashing Luca's head against a table, screaming, "You can't backstab a man like Ugo Piazza. You'd better not even touch someone like Ugo Piazza. Don't even go near someone like Ugo Piazza." Ugo Piazza is suddenly his best friend, and he's had it taken away from him. And so he kills Luca. But then the police turn up.
Followed Rocco from the police station.
Maybe they just figured if they let this puppy go, they could just follow him, and they would find something bad at the end.
And they did.
So that's it. So the end of the movie is basically it didn't work out for anyone, because now presumably Rocco is going to be locked up because he's just murdered Luca. Luca is dead. Nelly is possibly dead or certainly got a smashed face. Ugo is dead. And the camera just cuts to this cigarette that Ugo had left on the table. And that's the end. Crime does not pay.
No, it certainly does not.
That's the moral of the story. But, I mean, it's great. Isn't it great?
It's an amazing piece of work. This is, even if I did not know it, I would suspect that the people who wrote this film had literary aspirations. And, of course, Fernando del Leo was a published poet, writer of short fiction. He'd written a novel before he became a script writer.
Oh, that's true. Adapted from a short story, I believe, or there's a short story collection.
Yeah, written by someone else, something that he admired and was able to adapt. Yeah,
yeah. So it's got sort of literary origins. Although, according to Roberto Curti, there's like a couple of moments from this film that are taken from the book, and the rest was all Fernando de Leo's work.
Yeah, but who could argue with the finished product? Because
it's amazing.
This is simply amazing. This is brilliant from beginning to end, and of course. Of course, it's bleak and it's downbeat. I mean, this is what I would refer to as doomed from the start filmmaking. Mm-hmm. These are characters that never have any real hope. I mean, you like watching them go through the motions, and you, at a certain point, if it's done well enough, you actually are kind of really hoping that somebody gets away with this stuff.
Yeah.
But they're all doomed. I mean, there's this feeling throughout it. And it's helped by having the threat of the cops, you know, constantly, you know, harassing them and asking them questions and bothering them all the time. But the idea that kind of our futures are controlled by the powerful, no matter whether you're the cops or the criminals, either way, it's rather bleak. And it's this instance of watching these criminals trying to play this really rough hand that they've been dealt, kind of rough out whatever the situation presents them, and do as well with what they've got in front of them, and it's still never really being enough. It's bleak, but it's incredibly well done. It's like a great depressing novel, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, and there are so many stunning visuals as well. It's just really, really well shot. And I'm not just talking about Barbara Boucher dancing.
Oh no, it's beautiful. And this is one of the things where a good bit. Clearly, DeLeo had spent a lot of time before he got behind the camera as a director, soaking up the things that make other, you know, that make other films work. Mm-hmm. So his directorial hand is very firm. He knows what he's doing.
Yeah, and I think this film was also, I mean, the success of this movie and just the films that he went on to make were clearly an inspiration on other Italian filmmakers who went on to make these kinds of movies as well.
Oh, I agree. You can see this film, as successful as it was and as good as it is, being used as a template for years after the effect, mm-hmm. after the fact.
Yeah, which I'm sure we will probably notice when we
this when is we true.
Get going, yeah.
This being an early '70s film, let's. There's some idiosyncratic things about this. First of all, the joke that Troy Gwynn and I used to make when we first started the Nashie cast, which was the typical 70s ending, which means that it's downbeat where everybody dies. Everybody dies or everybody goes to jail. It's the typical 70s ending where you leave the theater going, oh, wow, okay. But the another typical 70s thing for this is the score, which I really like, but although the score was composed by Luis Enrique, is it Bacalov? It's performed by the progressive rock band Osana, who I knew nothing about. But I remember every time I've watched this movie, I think the same thing, which is it Jethro Tull doing the soundtrack? What the hell's going on here?
Right.
Because it is very prog rock at times, including the use of a flute. And so I'm just going, wow, it sounds a little Jethro Tull here. So it wasn't a shock to find out a little bit about this Italian prog rock band that did this, and to see, you know, like the, you know, they definitely included a flute and a saxophone and just everything else under the sun. And gotta admit, it gives it a different flavor. There's enough in the score that is typical of the times, but there's also those moments where you're like, oh, okay, this is a rock band. Really kicking it up here.
No, it's great. Yeah, I'm going to put in some bits in the show. Definitely, it's really fun, the music in this film. Yeah, and interesting that, because this is quite early, like we said, it's 1972, but the kind of score that this film has would be, you know, that's what I like about these films, is it is quite contemporary, and it's often very upbeat and pretty funky stuff that the composers were coming up with for these films. There's I often listen to some Polizia Teschi like compilation stuff on my on, you know, when I'm just sitting here doing some work, I'll have some of this stuff on in the background because the music is always so fun.
Another thing is the look of this film. I mean, yeah, the film came out in 1972, but I gotta admit, not quite all of the fashions and not quite every interior feels this way, but there's a certain kind of timelessness to what is on screen. It feels like something that is definitely taking place in the early 70s, but it doesn't feel ridiculous in its period detail. It feels a little like it could be taking place in the 60s, maybe even the 50s. You know, it doesn't feel like it's wedded to the early 70s, even though that's exactly when it was. Even the interiors, all the set design and stuff like that, it doesn't feel like you're looking at something that is striving really hard to present itself as 1972.
It's
very interesting. There's a timeless look to it that is very effective, and I don't know. That's one of those things where you wonder if when they were making the film they were going for that, or if it's just something that happened as they made it. I don't know.
It's also interesting that like, although it's set in Milan, it's not the beautiful touristy bits of Milan that we see. There's a little bit in the sort of piazza at the beginning of the film, but for the most part, it's all the modern industrial areas and the high-rise buildings that look like a kind of fairly modern, not particularly attractive city. It doesn't have that tourist aspect that you might expect with these films. So they sort of, it's very modern from that point of view as well, I suppose. But yeah, you're right about the clothes and the look of the film. Another thing I should mention, of course, as well as Rocco being Bruce Campbell, Ugo is not a million miles away from being Jason Statham.
And I was going to bring that up as well, because there's a point where at times in the first part of the film, Rocco is insulting Ugo and referring to him as potato because of that big shaved head of his.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not too much of a leap to see him, you know, because Ugo is trying to keep a very stone face, not give anything away, never get emotional, because he knows if he reacts to any of the stuff that they're doing to him, that'll just encourage them and they'll do more of it. And that is very similar to the way Statham plays a lot of his characters in different action films as well, where he knows that if he expresses himself in a violent way, or if he gets too out of a very thin area of actions, then he's going to pay a heavy price. And there's a similarity there, definitely.
So there you go then. So the remake of this film would star Jason Statham and Bruce Campbell. who would play Barbara Boucher's character?
Ooh,
that's the question. Probably Lily Collins, because she's in everything these days.
It's a good question. I have no idea. I never thought about it.
But yeah, those two, definitely. There's definitely Jason Statham vibes. I mean, this feels like one of those movies where he's a former gangster being dragged back in into this world he's trying to get out of. You know, it wouldn't surprise me to learn that people like Guy Ritchie watch these movies as well.
Oh, certainly they have to, because you can see the tendrils of the way they tell their stories. And even the kinds of stories, you can see them there. And I'm reminded of a movie that just came out last year, directed by Guy Ritchie, starring Jason Statham, called Wrath of Man. Really plays a lot like exactly this kind of movie. It has the same kind of feeling. And it's probably one of the reasons why I really liked Wrath of Man a lot, is the reason that I really like Caliber 9. I mean, they're the same kinds of film.
That's interesting. Oh, there you go. Yeah, definitely. Well, hey, thank you. I think we'll leave it there. We've got lots more to say about Polizia Teschi films coming up. Let us know if you're listening. Hopefully you will. If you're listening to me saying, if you're listening, then you are listening.
Then you're listening.
So let us know what your favourite Polizia Teschi films are, or any that you think we should be covering, and we can look at adding some in. You can contact us on Twitter and also on email. The links are all in the show notes. On Twitter, we are at The Wild Wild Pod. Email is wildwildpod@gmail.com, I think. But anyway, it's all in the it's all in the show notes. I don't
look at the show notes. Yes.
Yeah, it's all there. So please get in touch. It'd be great to hear from you. And yeah, thank you. Thank you, Rod. This is going to be a fun one, I think.
I think slightly, you're right, yeah.
I think there will be less painful films to sit through than we've currently, than our previous seasons have done, anyway.
Well, comedies are hard, man. Comedies are really difficult.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There you go. Okay. Thanks, everybody. I've got to go away now and remix our theme tune to sound more like it was made in the 70s. So, by the time this podcast goes out, hopefully we'll have some whacka whacka guitar.
maybe some flute you could Jethro Tull it.
Yeah, that's it. I'm going to have a go at progging it up. Right, thank you, Rod, and thank you everybody for listening. We will be back again soon for more police and gangster action. Bye.
Goodbye, everyone.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.